Hey, I'm a Narendra Maharaj. No, go on. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Gopi Jana Vallava Girivaradhari Gopi Jana Vallava Girivaradhari Yasoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana Yasoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Gopi Jana Vallava Girivaradhari Gopi Jana Vallava Girivaradhari Lava Girivaradhari Yasoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana Yasoda Nandana Raja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari Jayam Vishnupad Paramahansa Parivrajaka Acharya Stodara Satsi Srimadi Sri Bhakti Vedanta Swaman Prabhupada Ki Jai ISKCON Founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Jayam Vishnupad Paramahansa Parivrajaka Acharya Stodara Satsi Srimadi Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Ki Jai Anantakoti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai Nama Acharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai Prem Sakal Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhunitananda Sri Daita Gradhar Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gaur Gopinath Shama Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jai Giri Govardhan Ki Jai Giri Govardhan Ki Jai Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai Mayapur Dham Ki Jai Jagannath Swami Ki Jai Gangamayi Ki Jai Jamunamayi Ki Jai Tulsi Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Samaveto Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai All glories of the assembled devotees Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bol Hare Krishna. So we're going to read this verse from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 24, Text 25. The first word of this verse is tasmat, which means therefore. So, something led up to this verse. I'm just curious to see what it was. Anyone know what led up to this therefore? Yes. Interesting. Krishna's giving a sort of mechanistic view of life, explaining how there are three modes of nature, which you may have heard a few times in the Hare Krishna movement. There are three modes of nature. Then the mode of passion. Because of the material mode of passion, the clouds pour down rain everywhere. By this rain, all creatures gain their sustenance. Similar to what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita in chapter 3, that anad bhavanti bhutani parjanyad anasambhava, all creatures subsist on grains. Grains come from rains. So Krishna says, what has great Indra, Mahendra, what has great Indra to do with this arrangement? In other words, Indra Shmindra, I mean, with Indra, without Indra, it's still going to rain. At least that's what Krishna is saying here. Very interesting. And then Krishna says, my dear father, our home is not in the cities or towns or villages. We're forest dwellers. We always live in the forest and on the hills. Therefore, then we get the therefore. So because of all that, now you'll find out. So we'll chant this verse and see what the therefore is. Tasmat gavam brahmananam adres Charabhyatam Makaha Ya Indra Yaga Sambharas Thair Ayang Sadhyatam Makaha. Actually, I'll tell you a little bit what the words mean, so when you're chanting it, you may have some idea of what you're chanting. Tasmat means, therefore, gavam, for the cows, or of the cows, brahmananang, for the brahmanas, adres, and for the hill. Adri is a synonym of giri. And for the hill, cha, and arabhyatam, let it be begun. Maka, sacrifice. Let a sacrifice get underway. Let a sacrifice begin. Let a sacrifice begin, arabhyatang maka, therefore, for the cows, the brahmins, and the hill. Ya indra yaga sambharas. And the sambhara, sambhara here means ingredients, paraphernalia. So all the stuff, all the ingredients that were prepared for the indra yaga, for the indra sacrifice, tire with those ingredients, ayang, this sacrifice, sadhyatam, let it be carried out. Makaha, ayang maka, this sacrifice. Sadhyatam is just the verb from which you get the word sadhana, as in sadhana bhakti. So sadhana means carrying out, practicing. And so here the verb sadhyatam, let it be carried out. Let it be effected. Let it be done, this sacrifice. Tire with those ingredients that were for the Indra sacrifice. So anyway, we'll chant this now, and then we'll try to understand what this all means. We didn't chant Om Namo Bhagavate, did we? Okay, I'm a little bit out of order today, but that'll keep you awake. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Tasmat gavam brahmananam adres cha arabhyatam maka ya indra yaga sambharas tair ayang sadhyatam maka tasmat gavam brahmananam. Tasmat gavam brahmananam adres charabhyatang makab. adrishārabhyatāṁ makha ya indrayāga sambhārās ya indrayāga sambhārās tārayaṁ sādhyatāṁ makha tārayaṁ sādhyatāṁ makha tasmāt gavāṁ brāmanānāṁ adreśārabhyatāṁ makha ya indrayāga sambhārās tārayaṁ sādhyatāṁ makha. Tasmāt gavāṁ brāmanānāṁ adreśārabhyatāṁ makha tasmāt gavāṁ brāmanānāṁ tasmāt gavāṁ brāmanānāṁ adreśārabhyatāṁ makha ya indrayāga sambhārās sādhyatāṁ makha tasmāt gavāṁ brāmanānāṁ adreśārabhyatāṁ makha indrayāga sambhārās So the ladies, tasmāt gavāṁ brāmanānāṁ adreśārabhyatāṁ makha ya indrayāga sambhārās tārayaṁ sādhyatāṁ makha tasmāt gavāṁ brāmanānāṁ adreśārabhyatāṁ makha ya indrayāga sambhārās tārayaṁ sādhyatāṁ makha tasmāt gavāṁ brāmanānāṁ adreśārabhyatāṁ makha ya indrayāga sambhārās tārayaṁ sādhyatāṁ makha tasmāt gavāṁ brāmanānāṁ adreśārabhyatāṁ makha ya indrayāga sambhārās tārayaṁ. So tasmāt means therefore gavāṁ. Well, I explained that already, didn't I? Okay. So, the translation. Therefore, may a sacrifice for the pleasure of the cows, the Brahmins, and Govardhan Dhanhil begin. With all the paraphernalia collected for worshipping Indra, let this sacrifice be performed instead. There's a very short purport. Lord Krishna is famous as Go Brahmana Hita, the well-wishing friend of the cows and the Brahmanas. Lord Krishna specifically included the local Brahmins in his proposal because he is always devoted to those who are devoted to the godly Vedic culture. The word Govardhana, by the way, go means cows, as we know, and Vardhana in Sanskrit means growing or prospering. And so Govardhana literally means the hill which prospers the cows, which makes the cows grow or flourish and so on. That's what the word means. So, this is a very interesting verse. Today, of course, is Govardhan Hill. And, I mean, all kinds of important messages come out of this pastime. Of course, it begins with Krishna questioning his father about, what are you doing? Because he saw his father and the other elders of the village getting ready to perform this Govardhan Puja. And Krishna, first of all, he asks a very interesting question. I'm trying to find it here, which, I don't know if I'll do that. Which indicates that even 5,000 years ago when Krishna was here, I think I found it. Let's see. He asked whether this ceremony that you're about to perform is... Oh, here it is. He says, Tatra, this is text 7 of this chapter. Tatra tavat kriyad yogo bhavatang king vicharita. Why are you contemplating this ceremony? Atava lokikas tanme prichatak sadhvanyatam. He's saying, is this just lokika? Is this a Vedic ritual, or is it simply some worldly thing? In other words, even 5,000 years ago, people, there's what is called folk culture. People like in villages or towns, people just sort of devise their own little superstitious ceremonies and rituals. And so Krishna first wanted to clarify whether this is just something that someone invented. Is this some worldly ceremony, or is there some authority behind this? Anyway, then, so here in this verse, Krishna is stopping the worship of Indra. Now, in order to understand the impact of this, you have to understand that in the Rig Veda, which is, the word Rig means the hymns. So all the hymns that were chanted in Vedic sacrifices are found in the hymn Veda, the Rig Veda. And in the Rig Veda, most of the hymns are offered to Indra. So there was a time long ago when most worship was offered to Indra. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that he has come to reestablish religious principles because the actual spiritual science is lost, yoga nashta. And so here's an example of Krishna doing that. Krishna established religious principles not simply by killing demons. What does he say? That paritranaya sadunam vinashaya chaduskritam. Krishna certainly killed the demons who were promoting irreligion. But he also here, he's making a specific adjustment in contemporary religion. He's rejecting a particular activity, a particular ceremony, and instead substituting another activity. So this is Krishna in action reestablishing religious principles. That's one point. Then, of course, Indra is not going to take this well. And Indra will, of course, attack Vrindavan, and Krishna will then exhibit this extraordinarily creative and powerful pastime of lifting up a mountain and holding it like an umbrella. Don't try this at home. You could hurt yourself. So, of course, this is one of those great stories where Krishna saves his devotees. That's another common theme, that Krishna will actually protect us. But in his own way. When the residents of Vrindavan came to Krishna and asked for help, he kind of did it in a very unconventional way. Using a mountain as an umbrella is unconventional. It's very innovative. And so often in our own lives, I mean, we all have troubles because, guess what? We're in the material world. So if you don't have troubles, you're probably severely retarded. If you don't think you have troubles. So what is it said that everyone, people who are totally enlightened, totally pure and enlightened and just not even here, they don't suffer. And people who are extremely stupid sometimes don't suffer because they don't get it. They don't understand what's really happening. But most people actually suffer in this world, and that's Krishna's mercy it's sort of like an electric cattle prod to get us out of the material world. Krishna doesn't allow us to enjoy this world. So because we go through different miseries and troubles and anxieties as we again and again try to do the impossible and enjoy the material world, as we suffer, we turn to Krishna. And often we even have a proposal for Krishna of what we feel will be the best way to solve our problem. We often go the extra mile and actually suggest to Krishna our prayers what we think would do the trick for us. Krishna, however, is no one's jai man. So Krishna has his own innovative approach to these things. And Krishna will protect us and will save us, but he'll do it in his own way, in his own time, with his own style, which sometimes can be very frustrating and drive some people to atheism because they're not able to really master God. Isn't it? I mean, because you can take it mechanistically. And this is really what Krishna is getting at. This is really the essence of what Krishna is getting at in stopping the Indra sacrifice, that you cannot reduce religion, you cannot reduce spiritual life, you cannot reduce your relationship with God down to a mechanism. Because that's it. What's that? Oh, lift up the microphone. Okay. Good morning out there. So, because if you think about it, we try to learn a technique, like if you're playing a musical instrument, or if you want to be a stock investor, or if you're a builder, you're building a building, or whatever. I mean, there are techniques. Everything has its technique. And once you master the technique, you have mastered that particular activity. That's how people become expert. I mean, it's not always bad, because if you didn't master techniques, you would never be competent in anything. You'd never develop professional skills in anything. But still, that's how you do it. You do it over and over again. You repeat it. You study it. You master it. And then you're really good at it. And so we bring to our relationship with God this approach, because that's how we do everything else in the world. That's the basic psychology that one employs in developing or trying to develop competence, skill, ability in any activity. And so we come to Krishna consciousness, we're told, this is bhakti yoga, it's a science, here's the process, you know, connect the dots, get up at this time, chant these rounds, go to Mangal Arati, and so on. And yet Rupa Goswami warns us that if you think that it's all technique, you'll fall down. And therefore, we've seen some really brilliant sadhakas, people that were really great at sadhana bhakti, suddenly go down in flames. And people always scratch their heads and say, I can't figure it out. He, or you know, what was the, or she was the always the first one up in the morning, and they were doing everything right by the book. They seemed to really have this thing down. And the next thing you know, the guy has a job at McDonald's or something. And so Rupa Goswami explains this. There is a mentality, which is the basic mentality of material life, where we want to master bhakti yoga and even master our relationship with Krishna. For example, I've heard that Krishna protects his devotees, Krishna takes away the suffering of his devotees, I'm suffering, and therefore I go through prayers, I even put some oomph into it, you know, I try to be sincere, and I may even shed a tear, which I think really should accelerate the reward. And after we've gone through these techniques, it's like we sort of stand around looking at our watch. And then if it doesn't come when we wanted it, how we wanted it, then you start to have doubts about all this. So, or whatever, people respond in different ways. So it's precisely this approach to religion. And not only that, if you wonder why religions so often in this world become extremely boring, why people don't like long sermons, why, you know, I mean, every religion in the world, you see priests mumbling their little prayers because they've done it a million times. And it's because there's a tendency just to mechanize it, to get it down to this technique and to forget the essence. The essence is actually a personal relationship with Krishna. If you think about it, in our personal relationship, sometimes, like maybe you work in some place and every day you see the same people, or maybe you take a bus somewhere and you see the same commuters on the bus, and so people kind of say hello, good morning, and there's nothing really there. There's no real relationship. Even in marriages or friendships or guru-disciple relationships, things can just get very routine and very mechanical. And remember that song? Was it Where Has Our Love Gone? Anyway, it's Motown. So, those of you who are mature will know what I'm talking about. Babu, where's our love gone? So, So it's so bhakti yoga is really about bhakti. It's really about devotion. It's really, and it's letting Krishna be God, actually letting Krishna be the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And there's a tendency to encroach upon that when we think that it's all just technique. And if I did the technique right, I have a right to the result. So this, of course, this mechanistic approach to religion, which makes us dull and kind of, you don't really advance the way we'd like to, it's not only a problem in relation to the Supreme Lord, but also in demigod. Imagine demigod worship, where the demigods aren't even really... there's not a powerful personal relationship with the demigods, usually. It's just kind of like business. It's sort of a straightforward business thing. You give them their soma, you know, just make sure you're there at the jugga during the, you know, sort of the demigod happy hour. When you... pour the soma into the fire, and then, you know, they'll do good by you. So, but here, Krishna wants to sort of, he wants to blow up this whole thing. He wants to say that, no, there's real religion, real spiritual life, real reality is something else. Because this is not, this point is often made by historians, religion is not simply one aspect of life. Like, I go to the health club, and I go to school, or I go to the job, and I go to my church or temple or whatever. Religion has become, in secular society, simply one of the many activities that you do. But it's not really like that. Spiritual life really means that's your life. It's a whole way of life. That's what Krishna says. Jat Karoshi, whatever you do should be an offering to me. So here, Krishna is not simply adjusting the ritual that people perform when they happen to go to their local church or synagogue or mandir or mosque. It's not that. When Krishna says, I come to change dharma, to reestablish dharma, he doesn't just mean adjusting some details during people's, I don't know, you know, Sunday religious get-together. He's talking because dharma here means it's the way, it's the path, it's the whole approach to life. It's how you live your life. It's what you think reality is. And that's what Krishna is adjusting. So here, well, first of all, this is interesting. There were many Brahmins back then. They sort of had these rent-a-pundits, which you can see even in the... They still exist. Where, you know, you pay a fee and they'll come in and chant these mantras and everything. And it's kind of like a mafia, in a sense. I mean, every religion develops these priestly mafias because it's just like lawyers. Lawyers... Nothing personal, Army. Most people that get elected to Congress have some background in law. And therefore, the laws often are made so technical that you need a lawyer to navigate. In other words, if you don't want to become a victim of the law, if you don't want to lose in legal situations, you really need the help of a professional because the law is so technical. And therefore, the law becomes so complex that there's built-in, it's like a built-in survival strategy for lawyers. So, in the same way, there's a tendency, you can see if you study the history of religions, including Vedic culture, that the truth is really very simple. You just surrender to Krishna. You just have to love Krishna. Krishna says, sarva dharman parityaja. Give up all these complicated rituals and things. Just take shelter of me alone. I'll protect you. Don't worry about it. Masucha. Don't worry about it. I'll take care of it. Just become a simple devotee. Get up, you chant Krishna's name, you offer your food to Krishna, you love Krishna, hear about Krishna, and try to serve Krishna under the guidance of a pure devotee. No. What we really need is all kinds of elaborate technical rituals. And you can see how people become spooked by these things. They become superstitious, like, if I get married the Prabhupada way, where we just have a very simple ceremony and chant Hare Krishna, then who knows, you know, my marriage will blow up, or something will happen, or maybe my little child will get hit by a flying tractor or something that fell off a cliff. And so people actually become fearful and superstitious and nervous. And then to meet those needs you have, or to create those needs, you have a class of professional priests who make their living. They make their living by renting out their services. You can't just chant Hare Krishna. There's a long list of very technical mantras that you have to chant. If you don't, you don't at your own risk. I can't guarantee how long you'll live. how long your children will live, or I can't guarantee you won't be maimed or mutilated in this life. And so gradually what happens is people become more and more superstitious, the process of salvation becomes more and more technical and mechanistic, the priests are making a good living, and everyone forgets about love of God. And then a great reformer comes, whether it's a Jesus or a Chaitanya Mahaprabhu or a Prabhupada, a great reformer comes and sort of clears away all this baggage and says, let's get back to basics. You have to love God. So you can see this cycle. It goes on over and over again throughout history. I mean, we can see it everywhere. This tendency to sort of substitute a very technical, mechanistic thing to ward off, you know, dangers and because of superstitions, and to get away from the simple act of loving Krishna. So anyway, here Krishna is telling his father that let a sacrifice begin. A sacrifice for cows and Brahmins and the hill, Adri. So this is, in a sense, Krishna's making an economic argument. He's saying, look, our economy, we're dairy farmers, which is basically what they were. We are dairy farmers, and our economy is based on the cows and the hill, because that's where the cows graze. That's our economy. And he says, the Brahmins. Now, there were some Brahmins who were suggesting worship of Indra. But here, of course, Krishna must mean the Brahmins who are actually worshiping Vishnu. He says, take all this paraphernalia and use it for this sacrifice. And of course, clothes, and you have nature. You know, just the land. So really, you have, it includes all of nature. The human beings, the animals, and just nature itself, the hills. And somehow, all three of these become representatives of God. And so another lesson here, if you look at this verse closely, is that everything in the natural environment, the whole planet, which is basically human beings, non-human living creatures, and the land. And Krishna is saying, all of this actually is an extension of God. It's an expansion of Krishna, of me, and therefore you should worship God by seeing that all the world is sacred in that sense. Because if you consider Isha Vasimidang Sarvam, which literally means that we translate that everything belongs to Krishna, but to the Lord Isha, but it's interesting how it comes to mean that everything belongs to God. Because the word avasyam, Isha avasyam, vasa, of course, means residence or dwelling. And so avasyam means something which is to be dwelled in. And so everything, this whole world, is God's home. It's God house, it's God's house. It's a place where Krishna has the first right to dwell because it's his property. So if you think about it, just in terms of property in the sense of real estate, land or houses, that to say that you have the right to dwell in, to reside in, to enjoy a particular place means it's your property. So this is expressed by the word avasya. And sarvam, isha avasyam idam sarvam. Idam in Sanskrit, which literally means this, is often a shortcut, simply mean this world. This world, like om purnam idam, purnam idam. And so therefore, everything belongs to Krishna. The whole world is Krishna's residence. It's his place. And he's actually demonstrating this in detail here. It's because what is the world? It's human society. It's non-human society. It's the land itself. And Krishna is saying, all of this is an extension of me, somehow, in different ways, which is explained philosophically. So the world is sacred, properly seen. And when you actually see the world as sacred, you won't be inclined to exploit it. Because, I mean, an example of sort of becoming so crazy that you become totally oblivious to the sacred, you totally disregard the sacred, the holy. A great example of that is, of course, Nalakuvara, often pronounced Nalakuvera, but it's actually Nalakuvara, and Manigriva, the two sons of Kuvera. They were so drunk, they were sort of like celestial party animals in their teenage years. And they were, what they used to call it, skinny dipping. they were naked in the river with these lady friends. And Narada came by, who's a holy sage. Narada Muni is himself, the personified holiness. And even in Narada's presence, they were so out of their minds, they just, you know, they didn't react at all. They continued in that degraded way. So, I mean, there's two psychologies. When you actually understand that you're in the presence of the sacred, you behave yourself. That's why we have temples. The purpose of having an actual temple with deities is to create an atmosphere which is so overwhelmingly sacred, which is so obviously holy, that there's at least one place on the earth where you'll behave. And hopefully, by behaving in this one place, when you walk out the door, it'll become a habit. So here Krishna is giving us another way to see the world as sacred, because everything should be worshipped, representatives, the Brahmins representing human beings, the cows representing animals, Govardhan Hill representing nature, but everything as an extension of Krishna. So this is very good environmental policy. If we see the world as sacred, we won't trash it. So someone should preach this verse to the government. Any questions on these points? Trying to understand Krishna's Govardhan pastime. Yes. Go ahead. Oh, microphone. Oh, the talk show format. See if we can get two devotees to start fighting, you know, make it a real talk show.
Thank you very much for warning us about the danger of becoming mechanistic. And is there a danger of becoming mechanistic and technical in our association with the devotees?
Yeah, because Rupa Goswami also explains, we don't neglect the principles, but we don't. Our culture tends to be, I don't want to say highly, but it tends to be a very formalized ritual culture, in the sense that there are certain acceptable forms of address. You address people. You don't just say, hey, good buddy. It's like, Jai Prabhu. And so we have certain forms. I mean, formal in the sense, not that we wear tuxedos in the temple room, but or long gowns, but there are certain forms. There are certain acceptable forms of behavior, ways to address each other, offering obeisances. We have there's a certain hierarchy and so on. And so we can simply go through these motions, these forms, these formalisms, and there's a danger of not developing really meaningful, close, personal relationships, having like really meaningful friendships and loving relationships, because things just become kind of ritualized and formalized. That's a danger. Of course, another danger is to become too informal, and so the relationships become cheap or shallow or meaningless the other way, because we've given up all formality. And so this brilliant statement of Rupa Goswami, Niyamagraha, Niyama, which is, of course, the second limb of yoga, the Ashtanga Yoga, Yama, Niyama. And so Niyama means sort of to behave properly and so on. And then Agraha, Graha in Sanskrit, of course, from which we get the English word grasp or grab, means to take. And so Agraha, not grasping. Not grasping the niyama. Or ah, the long ah, which means intensely, in this case, intensely taken as an end in itself. So certainly associating with other Vaishnavas is probably the most important devotional practice. I mean, of course, chanting, but again, if we're with good devotees, we're going to chant. So associating with devotees is an extremely important devotional practice. And therefore, it must also be included in Rupa Goswami's warning. We should not neglect it, but also not just take it as a ritualistic formal thing. Because it's not that if you live in a temple with lots of devotees, you are invulnerable to Maya. Yes. Oh. Archie Tatro. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for the wonderful classicals, Maharaj. A lot of people, you know, they were doing the sacrifice to Indra. Obviously, they were thinking about abundance and the things they wanted to get, you know, and protect their crops and all that. And somebody the other day, one of my associates gave me a book on abundance and how you can prepare yourself and generate abundance in your life. And there's a lot of people out there, you're probably familiar with that, selling this idea that you can really create your own life and your own abundance, and that this is our responsibility, even as spiritual people, to do these things, etc. But what is the correct view, or from, you know?
It depends on why you want to create abundance and how you think you can do it.
And what can we actually do in this life? How are we?
If, for example, we certainly want to create abundance here at New Dwarka, because the more abundance there is, the more we can spread Krishna consciousness. We can create more and more facilities and opportunities for people to come in contact with devotees. We can give out an opulent prasadam. We can make books available to people. We can hold wonderful festivals. We can, you know, do all kinds of things. So it depends on why you want the abundance and then how you think you're going to get it. If you think you can independently get an abundance simply by the force of your psychology, that's kind of stupid. And there are some people that think, you know, if I want it, I can get it. It's just the force of my own mind will move the universe. And this is obviously pretty idiotic. I mean, to some extent, if you're a salesperson and you have a positive outlook, you'll probably sell more. But ultimately, all these things are, you have to take God into account also. Archita.
Let's keep the talk show going here. To get back to that first discussion, I think it was left a little bit hanging, so if I might.
Yeah, go ahead.
In everything, Srila Prabhupada set the example. I think Srila Prabhupada's first round of disciples were all quite intelligent, as far as I can see, reading the conversations that they had with Prabhupada. And they asked just about any question you can think of under the sun. And Prabhupada answered them brilliantly, either directly or in letters. So the guidance is there. How to dress, how to think, how to associate. We don't have to keep reinventing the wheel. It seems to me a lot of devotees always want to reinvent the wheel. How to dress properly, you know, in different situations, what to eat, where to go. I mean, Prabhupada answered all those things over
however,
and over again.
However, if I can play the, not the devil's advocate, I'll say what I really think is true. Prabhupada had the power, and he actually did it. He actually built a house in which the whole world could live. One time, a devotee in the old Brooklyn temple wrote to Prabhupada and said that this devotee was frustrated because this devotee knew that everyone, according to Prabhupada's teachings and human reason, everyone should act a certain way and dress a certain way and eat a certain way. And Prabhupada said that you're impersonalism. You don't respect the variety of individual natures. And so when we study Prabhupada's teachings, and you're right, Prabhupada gave us all this guidance, we find that there's tremendous diversity in Prabhupada. There's tremendous... Prabhupada, if you pick a particular subject, you can see Prabhupada making various statements on the subject. Why? Because Prabhupada was very keenly aware of the variety of human nature. And therefore, he was creating a house in which everyone could live. Now, it also... there is jnana and vijnana. I mean, Prabhupada certainly gave us his... unique and powerful realization. But then again, there is realization of Prabhupada's realizations. And that's what keeps the parampara living. In other words, it's not like, I remember, you know, in the early days of the movement, I hope it was the early days, where you join the movement and it was kind of like, you're not paid to think. You know, there's someone here who thinks and no one else needs to think. And if you do think, you don't understand bhakti yoga. Now, there's something to be said for boot camp. I went through boot camp, and I think, you know, everyone else has to suffer too. No, but it's really good. I mean, boot camp is really good. When you join the Hare Krishna movement, you know, tabula rasa, blank slate, just be submissive, just be humble. That's boot camp. I mean, you can't spend the rest of your life in boot camp. And Prabhupada was very strong on this point. Prabhupada very much wanted to develop a class of intelligent, autonomous, self-reliant, but faithful Vaishnavas. That's the reason why Prabhupada was just ferociously opposed, I mean just powerfully opposed to centralization of management. Because he said he would kill individual initiative. He would kill individual initiative. And therefore, Prabhupada very insisted that his disciples, and of course his followers, everyone is a follower of Prabhupada, that they have the space, without creating a disturbance in society, but we have the space and the freedom to follow our personal inspiration, to be creative, to be intelligent. You know, your brain, use it or lose it. And so ultimately, ISKCON is meant to be a society where we cooperate. We are disciplined. We are, you know, we're not anarchists. We're not wild-eyed rebels. But at the same time, it's supposed to be a Brahminical movement. Every Brahmin is an independent thinker within reasonable boundaries which are established by Prabhupada. So if you look at Prabhupada's teachings, Prabhupada didn't just give us like these very tight, very technical, extremely specific marching orders on every point. Now, some things he did. It's 16 rounds. If you want to be initiated, 16 rounds. It's four regular principles. If you want to be a serious practitioner of bhakti yoga, you get up early, you go to Mangalarti, you chant your rounds, etc., etc. You offer obeisances in the temple. So there are certain things, but if you look at the things which Prabhupada really insisted on, that it's specifically this and nothing else, there are actually very few. And in terms of lifestyle, what kind of food do you cook to offer? You know, Prabhupada 4.8.54 in the Bhagavatam, whatever is convenient in your life and where you live. How do you worship the deities? Whatever is convenient. Obviously within reasonable boundaries. So I think it's very helpful to think of Prabhupada not as giving us, well, Prabhupada is giving us boundaries. It's just like Lakshman drew a boundary for Sita. And within that circle, Sita was protected. So Prabhupada drew a circle for us. He drew a cultural circle. That's the way we can look at it. Prabhupada drew for us a cultural circle. And within that circle, you are safe in Krishna consciousness. And some people are on this side of the circle, and some people are on that side, some people, whatever. But as long as you're within these boundaries, you are a bona fide follower of Prabhupada, and you are spiritually safe. And if someone tries to reduce that space that Prabhupada gave us, in which the whole world can live, and try to sort of shrink it into a little point, and say, everyone has to be like me, and everyone has to see Prabhupada exactly the way I see Prabhupada, it becomes cultish, and it becomes claustrophobic. And so the real point is to acknowledge and to... Boy, I sound like a New Age guru. Acknowledge and honor. Could I get into this? But we do have to acknowledge and respect the fact that Prabhupada gave us this space, which is big enough so that no one... If you actually understand Prabhupada, no one's going to feel claustrophobic in ISKCON. No one's going to feel they're being driven out of this movement. No one's going to feel that I can't be creative, that I can't think, that I can't be intelligent, that I can't have my personal inspiration, which is exactly what Prabhupada wanted you to have, your personal inspiration. And when the Krishna consciousness movement is functioning properly, it's a balance between discipline, order, there has to be some hierarchy. At the same time, everyone feels there's space in this movement for me to be creative, inspired, intelligent, to think, and so on and so forth, within this safe cultural space that Prabhupada created.
Brilliant answer. Thank you very much, Maharaj. Just to tie it into your other point about love, if there is love for Prabhupada, then there will be this real, real deep attachment to cooperation. Prabhupada demonstrated that in Hawaii once. There was a group, I think we all know, who split it off from the mainstream. And Prabhupada went there to try to mediate. So he called them all together. And he said, you're not getting along with the temple authority. They said, no. They gave their explanation. So Prabhupada said, well, I'm asking you to please do that. Do you love me? And they said, yes. He said, if you love me, please cooperate. And they said, no, we won't. And he slammed his fist and said, just see. So love means that there has to be that real deep commitment to cooperation. Not that I'm so independent and so stubborn that, you know, everybody else is coming to glorify Prabhupada. And, you know, and I come in and I just stand in a corner with my hands in my jeans pocket and I look, you know, these kind of things are just not required.
Yes, thank you very much for that point. We have to cooperate. And there's room for everybody. There really is room for the whole world in this movement. If someone feels that I can't find my space in ISKCON, they really just don't understand what ISKCON is. Because the real ISKCON, and I don't mean now some mystic, you know, the greater ISKCON, which includes all kinds of deviant groups. But I mean the real officially incorporated ISKCON. The real ISKCON, if you actually understand it, there's space for everybody. It's a big world out there. And everyone can serve to their heart's content within Prabhupada's mission. Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. A new bhakta was asking me that in the beginning stages of Krishna consciousness, we're still under the influences of planets and demigods. So, is it...
No, I mean, whatever. I was personally in Prabhupada's room, right up here, right here, just above us, when some well-known devotee astrologers came to Prabhupada, and that was the first time they kind of officially asked for permission to do astrology in ISKCON. And Prabhupada sometimes, in sort of a very casual way, very sort of dabble a little bit, like just out of curiosity, but he never made important, really important decisions based on that. So Prabhupada, I was sitting right next to Prabhupada, about this far from him, and these devotees kept arguing about the need for astrology, and Prabhupada said, no, we don't really need it in ISKCON. And the reason he gave was, basically said, que sera, sera. You know, whatever will happen, let it happen, we depend on Krishna. Now all of us, maybe to a little extent, dabble in astrology. But if it becomes a way of life, you really are not getting bhakti yoga. Because, again, it's a control mechanism. It's a way to get control. By the way, it's not my experience that people that are into astrology seem to have better lives than other people. It's just personal observation. They often have problematic lives. Often astrologers don't seem to have their lives together perfectly. The whole essence of bhakti yoga is to depend on Krishna, to believe that only Krishna can protect me. If I surrender to Krishna, if I give myself fully to Krishna, Krishna will never let me down. Krishna will protect me, take care of me. And of course, as I said, a little astrology, everyone dabbles a little bit. But it becomes a way of life where you can't cross a street unless you, you know, check the stars. It's just not mentioned. I mean, read the Bhagavatam, for Krishna's sake. Read the Bhagavatam, where Krishna, for example, the 11th canto and other places, gives this very long and detailed list of the practical procedures of bhakti yoga, including details about festivals and chanting and ceremonies and study of scriptures. These very detailed lists of how to practice bhakti yoga. Where is astrology? Read the Nectar of Devotion, where Rupa Goswami gives into very... elaborate detail on how to serve Krishna, how to practice bhakti yoga. Where's the astrology? So clearly, it's some people eat too much prasadam and get a little, little tubby. And some people get too much into astrology, and some people speculate too much. And I'm involved a little bit in academic service. Devotional service. Some people get too much into academics and you can become so intellectual you become stupid. And some people have demonstrated that because you forget the simple truth. So astrology, you know, a little bit whatever. Prabhupada did a little bit. But it's one of those things, if you do it too much or take it too seriously, you really are deviating from the heart of bhakti yoga.
You mentioned earlier about the Renta Pundits from
yes.
time immemorial. So many people, they get into this, into the astrology so heavily, and then they make it a living for themselves. Are they perpetuating that cycle of...
Well, I don't want to criticize any particular individual, but I think enough has been said. Just we should, you know, a word to the wise, let the buyer beware. So I guess we'll stop here. It's getting a little bit late. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.